disclaimer. The following broadcast gives a true and honest account of the events described, and all evidence and details herein are solely factual. What you are about to hear is real and may disturb you. Caution is strongly advised. Welcome to Dead Souls Social Club.
If you enjoy our show and find our research interesting, please consider supporting us. Head over to ko-fi.com/deadsouls. That's ko-fi.com/deadsouls. And donate a few bucks to our research and investigations. We truly appreciate you helping us out. You can also find us over on Instagram if that's more your thing. Just search Dead Souls Podcast and we'll come up. As always, thank you for joining us. This is Sleep Paralysis Part 2. Empirical Malevolence. I'll keep the introduction brief, as I'm keen to jump right in. The events I'm going to talk about in this episode permanently changed me, and have a long-lasting effect on my life right up until the present day. This is a very personal story for me, and slightly different in nature to what we have produced before. I think it will tell you guys a lot about me, and who I am, and also why I do what I do. This episode has been a long time in the writing, mainly because it's been difficult for me to come to a comfortable place with how much I want to open up within the walls of this story. I might face ridicule, questions, and a whole array of negativity, or I might face responses in a positive fashion. Regardless, this is my truth, my story, my history, and this is how I got here. It has been suggested that those who experience some form of childhood trauma or abuse are more susceptible to sleep paralysis. It's a medical given, so to speak, that dreams are a way for our brains to process memories and events, converting them from short-term into long-term memory, as well as allowing us to process emotional problems that we experience. A dream can be a gift to a psychologist in some instances, but also something of negative effect. A colleague of mine once theorized that could sleep paralysis simply be that process of dream transcription, but one where the transcription leaks into another state of consciousness? My colleague, the PhD, spent a number of years studying sleep paralysis, in particular while at university, and his published findings were quite extraordinary. I won't jump ahead though, we'll come to that eventually. Maybe, he went on, sleep paralysis is simply our brains dealing with our past traumas and fears in a way that we can't quite comprehend. Although, psychologically speaking, there are a number of ways our subconscious already does this fairly efficiently, I posed, so why would it need a secondary coping mechanism or interpretation methodology? I will gesture that the human body often has more than one trait to complete and counter specific ailments, conditions, diseases, and invaders. Anyway, I'm flying off course already. I could digress for days, I swear. Catch me at a bus stop, dinner party, or a business conference, and you're doomed. To alleviate the devil is to proffer realms of small talk and the such. Anyway. Okay, so personal history time. I was born in the 1980s, a time of great horror movies, terrible fashion, the AIDS crisis, yuppies, Ronald Reagan, Margaret Thatcher, and very questionable pop music. But I got to experience absolutely zero of that because I was a child of the 90s. That is my formative years, and years that I can really recall in detail were all within the 1990s, a decade that I often think to myself wasn't that long ago at all, but in fact were 30 years ago in the past. Madness. I hardly knew my birth parents. Fortunately, I was lucky enough to have two amazing grandparents who would raise me. I was very fortunate in that my grandparents were the sweetest, most caring, loving, intelligent, funny, and heartwarming souls that I have ever come across on my journey through life. I really consider myself blessed. I grew up in the Welsh countryside, a small village deep in the heart of the famous Welsh valleys. My grandparents had an old house on the outskirts of the village. Three large bedrooms, a beautiful view of the river and valley from the upstairs balcony, and situated in a tiny village of just a few hundred people. Yes, everybody knew everyone else's business, which was a blessing and a curse, but I wouldn't have traded it for the world. The village has a wealth of history that dates back well before the time of the Doomsday Book in 1086. Even though my village was much further west than our Anglo-Saxon friends at the time dared to record. For the purposes of anonymity and security, I'll refer to my home village as Colford. I'll change a number of other names and locations in this episode to protect the identities of all those involved. But know that the names and locations are the only things in this episode that have been changed. Everything else discussed is entirely real, truthful, and accurate. By the time I was born, both of my grandparents were in their mid-50s. My grandmother had already retired. She was a dancer when she was younger. She liked to remind me of that often and tell me stories of her time dancing in the theatre. After that, she had a career running a charity for terminally ill children. She loved children, and I always thought she was born to be a grandmother. She had all the habits of a great one. Loving, intelligent, warm, caring, and so, so funny. We used to love staying up late on weekends and watching movies. I loved horror. She loved comedy. John Candy was her favourite. Our joint favourite movie was The Burbs, starring Tom Hanks. Hilarious and a hokey kind of horror. My grandmother had such a larger-than-life and mischievous laugh. Hearing it was sweet music to my ears. Me and her laughed for hours at movies or television or jokes that we heard. Pure bliss. My grandfather was Bernard Black. He was a psychologist and worked at the well-known Whitchurch Psychiatric Hospital in Cardiff, South Wales. He was always interested in people and their behaviours, which is why I guess that he went into the line of work that he did. He was well-read and probably the most intelligent person that I had ever met. He was always reading a book, sat in his armchair, sat at the dinner table, as a passenger in the car, always a big old hardback in his hand, and he was engrossed. I was always fascinated with his home office as a kid. Three walls, floor to ceiling with books and a desk by a huge bay window that was always filled with various papers, documents and photographs that would catch my eye, and most of the time, scare the shit out of me. His side hustle, so to speak, was that he was a member for the Society of Psychical Research. The SPR, for those who haven't heard of them, are a non-profit organisation headquartered in Kensington, London. They've been around for about 140 years now, and their main purpose, or mission, if you will, is to study and document events and people with abilities that fall into the category of the paranormal. My grandfather's personal interests and areas of expertise in particular were those of telepathy, extrasensory perception, hauntings, and poltergeist activity. He lived for it, and it's 100% where I gained my interest in those areas from, amongst others, of course. My grandfather Bernard was a quiet man, but would relish spending huge amounts of time with me as a child telling me stories of his time in the Royal Navy, or about the various people he had met over the years, and astonishing things that he had seen. Always edited for a younger audience, of course. When he wasn't spending time with me directly, I would usually play with Legos on the floor of his study as he worked. We were forever comfortable in each other's company. He was great. He was my dad. One of my grandfather's closest friends was a man called David Fontana, a psychologist who lectured at Cardiff University when I was a kid. They often met and discussed each other's work and research, and even though I never understood what they talked about, I loved sitting in the armchair across the room and eavesdropping into their conversations. It was David who introduced my grandfather into the SPR, and David would go on to head the non-profit organization for a brief period of time in the 1990s. I know what you're all thinking, by the way, and the answer is yes. My grandfather did know Maurice Gross. They worked on a number of research events throughout the late 1980s and 1990s, and also co-wrote a paper for the SPR regarding precognition in 1996. Anyway, I digress. Apologies for the clangor of a name drop. The Society for Psychical Research still operates to this day since its 1882 inception. Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, the author of Sherlock Holmes, was a member until 1930, and in the early part of the 20th century, Sigmund Freud would contribute to the Society's regular research publication. Noteworthy investigations were conducted by the Society, and those include the Bawley Rectory, often cited as the most haunted location in the United Kingdom, and also the infamous Enfield poltergeist case between 1977 and 1979. With this in mind, I'm sure you can ascertain for yourselves what the standard of investigation that the SPR is known to conduct. Its official stated purpose is to understand and investigate events and abilities commonly described as psychic or paranormal. Areas of study publication include hypnotism, disassociation, thought transference, mediumship, Reichenbach phenomena, apparitions, haunted houses, and the psychical phenomena associated with seances. telepathy, extrasensory perception, and demonic anomaly have also been on the roster in the past 50 years or so. My grandfather was an active member, and with his scientific background and qualifications in the field of psychology, he was a true and useful asset for the society. As a kid growing up, I always wanted to accompany my grandfather on his investigations, or day trips as he called them, but I was never allowed. I guess these sort of things are no place for children. My grandfather was always very careful and selective about what he told me about his work for the society, and I always knew he was holding back. But that only intrigued me more, but it also terrified me in equal measure. The fear of the unknown, they say, is far greater than the knowledge of what's within its realms. For a number of years, Dad had a framed photograph on his study wall that terrified me. It was taken at night, but the subject of the photograph was plain and as clear as day. It showed a human-shaped figure walking into a group of trees and heavy foliage. The figure was around 5 feet tall and was looking directly at the camera, no doubt signaled by the photographer's presence and the camera flash that lit it up. The figure was clearly not a human form, at least not in the traditional sense. The humanoid wasn't wearing any clothing in the picture, and its skin was a light, powdery grey. The most chilling aspect of the image, though, was the head and face. The head was quite large compared to the size of its body. It possessed a thin and slight body frame. It had large, black, emotionless eyes and a small mouth, no nose that was visible. There was a caption printed in the frame below the image that simply read, "Wistmans, Devon, 1978. I would stare at the image for hours over the years, concocting all manner of fearful thoughts about who the man in the picture was and what was going on at the time of the picture. Some things I knew not to ask my grandfather. I guess I knew the answer would be watered down, but also, at the back of my mind, I was also terrified that he would actually tell me the full story. My grandmother saw me looking at the picture a few times, and she would always say the same thing to me. "Oh, I hate that picture. Bloody ugly thing." When I got a little older, it became apparent to me what it was, and I didn't need to ask my grandfather anything more. At least, I didn't feel that I had to, and I never wanted to know under what circumstances he got the photograph. It's a huge regret of mine not having a conversation about the photograph, or a number of other things with my grandfather, actually. I wish I had persisted and pushed him on a number of topics when I had the chance. But truth be told, when I was younger, I was always too afraid of my grandfather's work to ask or to probe it, and my shared interest with him didn't emerge until many years later, until he had sadly passed away. A number of years later, once both of my grandparents had sadly left this earth, I got to help my wider family in clearing their old house. Some items would be sold, some would be disposed of, and some would be inherited by family members. Aside from a financial inheritance, my grandparents hadn't left me any physical items of theirs in their will, so my uncle gave me the option of having something of theirs from their home to remember them by, anything that I wished. The wider family had the same opportunity. My grandparents had quite the number of items which had considerable value: antiques, art, books, furniture. My grandfather was also a gadget lover, so there were also plenty of interest in electronic devices to choose from. I surprised no one in the family, however, when I chose to keep all of my grandfather's files, documents, photographs, and investigation logs. The family knew I had developed a fascination with this stuff, and it became somewhat of a given that I would follow in my grandfather's footsteps. My Uncle George even thought it was fitting to start calling me Spooky, which somehow stuck in my family, and they all call me that to this day. Anyway, that's all backstory. What's past is prologue. Preface to the poetry, an exordium for the forthcoming, Le Noir et les Morts. How does any of this tie in with sleep paralysis? Well, as I mentioned in the previous episode, for a few years as a child, I experienced sleep paralysis fairly often over the course of a few years. The descriptor of events in part one of this series documents exactly what I experienced regularly. I recommend checking out our prior episode before listening to the rest of this one. Again, as I previously mentioned, the sleep paralysis period I lived through was from the age of around 8 to 11 years old. This is important. Jumping ahead now, I was always an indoors kid. I'd much prefer sitting inside playing with Legos, my science kits, computers, or with my dog Noodle, than venturing outside and playing soccer or rugby with the other boys. Generally, the furthest I'd venture as a kid was the garden. I guess I've always been like that, even until now. A definite homebody, as they say. Around the age of 5 or 6, I met a new friend in the neighbourhood. She was a girl my age, and we sat for hours talking and playing with my little dog. I used to tease her because her name was Gladys, and it was such an old-fashioned name. I used to say that my parents' best friend was called Gladys, and that she would tease me back and say that Jamie was a girl's name. We were totally comfortable and at ease in each other's company. I can still picture Gladys now. She was such a tomboy, and was always in a pair of old jeans and a scruffy t-shirt, usually with grass stains on her knees from rolling around in my grandparents' garden, and building dens and forts behind the trees at the bottom of the garden. Gladys had dirty blonde hair, always tied back in a ponytail. For some reason, when I picture her now, I always imagine her in this white Garfield t-shirt that she loved to wear. I called her Glad, and she called me Jam. Glad was always fun to be around and such a free spirit. The only thing that she was ever uptight about was making her mother angry. Her mother was pretty strict, and if she gave Glad a time to be home or was making dinner and Glad was late, she would go through the roof, so to speak. She was pretty neurotic, really, thinking back. Glad and I were pretty close friends for about 2 years overall, between the ages of 5 to 7. Well, the next part of my story is what's the most difficult part for me, the hardest element of the story for me to communicate. Possibly because it's also the most difficult element of the story for you, the listener, to digest and accept, I guess. You see, Gladys, my friend, well, she was imaginary. I could see her and talk to her, and Noodle the dog could see her and interact with her. But no one else could. I mean, imaginary friends amongst preteens is a fairly common phenomenon. In fact, around 28% of children between the ages of 5 to 12 years old experience imaginary friends. WebMD research states that imaginary friends amongst younger children is even higher, with around 65% of children under the age of 7 having them. Girls experience the phenomenon more frequently than males. My grandfather, given what he did, found it really interesting that I saw, played, and talked to Gladys. He found it more interesting that our dog could also see her, and he often witnessed Noodle interacting with a non-visible Gladys. Kids will be kids, right? Along with observing, my grandfather also documented as many instances as he could where I would play with Gladys. At the time, as a 5-year-old, I was pretty unaware of him doing so. He would just sit in the room with us. It wasn't until years later, when I would inherit his documents, that I would see just how much that he documented, and I got to read it all. My grandfather surmised in his research that my imaginary friend Gladys wasn't imaginary at all. He dismissed any notion of shared psychotic disorder or Lesigue-Fallot syndrome. For one, because the two individuals who could see and hear Gladys were a human and a canine, and there is simply no recorded instance of a folie à deux occurring interspecies ever. Nor would it even be scientifically possible, given the SPD triggers, which are known to be communicated and reinforced by shared delusion. Further, since Charles Lesigue and Jules Fallot discovered the SPD syndrome in 1877, it has been downgraded and no longer features in the DSM, or Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders. Instead, it's now considered a symptom, or rather a side effect in some cases, of general schizophrenia disorder. I definitely didn't have schizophrenia, or any other mental illness for that matter, so my grandfather was content to explore other ideas, it seems. Reading back over documentation that adds narration to your life 30 years prior is kind of weird, by the way. My grandfather documented something particularly interesting one evening. He noted how, once again, I was sat on the floor of his study, talking with Gladys, and on this occasion, using pencils in a colouring book. He noted how interesting it was that I was having a thorough conversation, but only my side of the discussion was audible, obviously, but that not a step was missed or seemed forced. It was entirely natural, as if actually conversing with another person. Here's the kicker, the exclamation mark in the notes. Gladys, it seems, told me, child me, that she had to get home as it was getting late. We said our goodbyes and away she went, through the door to my grandfather's study, which was halfway open. My grandfather documented that, and I quote directly from what he wrote here. Jamie said goodbye to his friend, looking toward the study door, smiling and giving a small wave. I cannot be sure, nor is this any weighted evidence, but the study door, a large old thick oak beast, most definitely did move ever so slightly and in the absence of draft. A small measure, of course, but I'm sure of what I saw. As I said, this was evidence of nothing, but it did make my grandfather look closer. He watched with increased interest. So my birthday is in May, and in the summer following my 7th birthday, things seemed to change in the house. Our family dynamic and love remained as strong as it always was, but there was something new amongst us. Something new in the house, in the air. It started, and I can remember this as clear as if it was yesterday, on a Friday evening in early June. Gladys and I were playing video games in my bedroom. She jumped up, startled. She'd realized that she was late, and it was getting dark outside. I had said to her that it will be okay and asked if I should come with her and explain to her mother how it was my fault that she was back after dark. Glad refused, teary-eyed, and ran out. It seemed innocent enough. After she left, I resumed playing video games. Later that night, after everyone had retired to bed for the night, the front door was banged upon. It was around 2 to 3 a.m. I think I heard the banging before my grandparents did, because I remember laying in bed awake for around 10 minutes before I heard my grandparents stir. The banging on the door was frequent and harsh, like an angry person wanting to get in. Our village was a quiet, sleepy little place. This was far out of the norm. The thudding continued. I was a little scared. What kind of idiot would want to come in the house at this hour of night? And so urgently too. It surely couldn't be anything good, whatever they wanted. I think my grandfather had similar thoughts and feelings. I could hear him say to my grandmother, "Stay here, near the phone." My grandmother stood in the doorway to her bedroom, which was at the top of the stairs. She could see right down the stairs and to the front door, so had a pretty good viewpoint where she was. The banging continued, forceful, focused. "Yes, yes," my grandfather said loudly as he made his way down the stairs. I poked my head out of my room. "What's happening?" I said with sleepy eyes to my mam. "Come here, love," my grandmother responded, beckoning me the length of the upstairs hallway toward her. I did, and she put her arms around me from behind as we both stared down to my grandfather at the front door. Boom, boom, boom. The thudding hit out again. My grandfather was at the door now. He glanced back at us with a pensive look, as if, "Here goes." And with a security chain fastened to the door, he slowly opened it. Silence. "Who's there?" my grandfather said through the crack in the door. No response. He asked again and gave it a minute, waiting for a response or at least some kind of sound. Nothing. Just the gentle breeze of the night air blowing through the trees in the garden. My grandfather slowly undid the chain lock and pulled the door back quickly. Again, nothing. There was no one there. The way a house was positioned meant that if you went out of the front garden, you could clearly see in both directions of the lane that we lived on. And the thick hedgerows on both sides of the lane, it would have been, well, impossible for anyone to have cut into a field and out off the road. The front garden was empty. There was no one around. There was no one up either of the trees situated in the garden. There was no one in either direction down our lane, and not a sound, not a peep audible in the night air. "There's no one there," my grandfather said. He was standing in the garden, visible through the front door. He looked somewhat baffled. It was a strange incident, that's for sure, and one that has sat in my psyche for many years. It stands out because it was the start of a very long summer. The night that Gladys left in a hurry was the last time that I would see Glad. She didn't come over anymore. We didn't hang out. And she had up and disappeared from my life. My grandfather documented this in his files. We'll return to that. Vlad slowly faded from my memory as friends do at that age, replaced with others that you meet at school or while out with other friends. Once in a while I would ask one of my grandparents where she was, but they would always seem distant with their answers, which I guess influenced me to be the same. And she was gone from my mind eventually. The same weekend, the banging door incident happened. Things progressed. The very next evening, I was getting ready for bed. The bathroom was the next room along the upstairs hallway to my bedroom. I was stood in there, on a small stool. Remember, I was only 7 years old. At the sink, brushing my teeth. Sometimes, when you ran the hot water, the old pipes in the wall behind the bathroom and my room would clunk gently. Nothing loud or intrusive, just a gentle clunking as they piped hot water from the boiler to the taps. I ran the hot tap and the clunking began as it always did. A numb, rhythmic dunk, dunk, da-dunk. It usually repeated itself about 2 to 3 times after the tap was turned off, and tonight was no different. I popped my toothbrush in the cup on the sink and wandered into my room as the final round of dunk, dunk, da-dunk played out. But this time it stopped dead the second I set a single foot into my room. It was a dunk, dunk, duh, then nothing, complete silence. It wasn't so shocking that it scared me or stopped me in my tracks, it was just something that I noticed. My grandmother was in her room down the hall, so the hall light and the light in her room was on. She called up. "I'll be there in a minute, chicken." Did anyone else's grandparents call them chicken, or was it just a Welsh thing? I don't know. Anyway, she would come and tuck me in, and was about to do that very thing. I kept walking into my room. The light was off, as the hallway outside lit it up sufficiently, and I got to around a meter from my bed when I stopped dead in my tracks. There was someone standing in the corner, next to my bookcase and closet door. The closet door was painted white, so I could see the silhouette of a grown person, a man or a woman, I wasn't sure, but it was as plain as day, standing there, motionless. I froze for what seemed like an eternity. It might have been a second, it might have been 47 years. Then, as I was about to cry out for my grandmother, it suddenly became deathly cold. And my ears... Well, the best way I can describe it was, you know when you were on an aeroplane and the pressure causes your ears to pop? Well, that happened, but followed by a few seconds of white static noise really loudly in my head. The pop from the ear pressure made me wince in pain a little, and I scrunched my face and eyes closed. When I opened them, even though the room was still freezing, the shadow of the person in the corner had gone, seemingly vanished. I say vanished, as I would have known if they pushed past me to get out of the room, but no one did. My grandmother came in shortly after to tuck me in and commented that it was cold in the room and asked if the window was open. It wasn't. I was in floods of tears and terrified. I explained the whole thing to my grandmother, who then had to thoroughly search my closet and room twice over with me to witness before I would be convinced that there wasn't some creepy man in my room. It also took the company of my grandmother, sat on the chair next to my bed, all night, for me to sleep. Bless her heart. I didn't say to anyone at the time, but the moment that I saw the shadow, a great wave of sadness, despair, and misery came over me. It lasted for the duration of the incident, I guess, but I remember that feeling like it was yesterday, like a machine had sucked all the happiness out of the room, and I was left with futility. Misery. From that night on, I felt that I was being watched in that house. Not a slight feeling, but a strong notion that there was someone in the darkness, in the shadows, or hiding behind doors and curtains, but definitely watching and following me around the house. Going upstairs alone became difficult. I was terrified most of the time. If I was alone, like if I was in the kitchen and my grandparents were in another part of the house, and the feeling would come over me, I would slowly jerk around doors to see if anyone was there, or call out, "Who's there?" actually expecting a response, although dreading it at the same time. Sometimes, out of the corner of my eye, I would catch a quick movement of someone walking or running, into a room, out of a room, but always to another vantage point of hiding. I knew there was someone there watching me, but I was also too terrified to tell anyone. They'd think I was stupid, or a baby, or mad. They'd tell me it was my imagination. It definitely wasn't. I specifically recall one night a few weeks after the shadow figure incident. My grandmother got a phone call. Her mother, my great-grandmother, who was 98 at the time and in a care home, had injured herself in a slight fall. It wasn't serious, but it made my grandmother want to go to the care facility right away and check on her. My grandfather would drive her. The care home was only about 4 minutes away by car in the same village, and my grandparents didn't intend on being long, so told me to stay playing in front of the television and not leave the room or answer the door to anyone. Hey, back then, parents could get away with this type of thing. It happened quickly, the call came, and my grandparents were up and were off. It was around 8 p.m. on a Sunday evening, so the television shows were all rubbish and for old people. But I was happy to have the TV on as background noise as I played with a toy called Micro Machines that existed back then. Anyone remember these? I loved them. Anyway, the toys were miniature cars, but you could also get miniature shrunken cities as playsets, and I had loads of those. My favourite playset was one called Super Van City, which, at the time, happened to be in my bedroom. I wanted it. But I was scared to open the living room door, let alone go upstairs and down the hallway to my room, all alone. In a stupid moment of sheer commando-like bravery, I decided that I wanted the toy more than I was willing to let fear control me. And I worked up the confidence, which included lots of deep breaths, and swung open the living room door. My plan was to get up to my room, grab the toy, and run back down, not looking at anything or anywhere, with all the lights on as quick as humanly possible. So, I opened the door of the living room and darted down the hall, past the kitchen door, to the light at the bottom of the stairs. It was dark, and that was not ideal, but I did it. The stairway light was high up and stiff as it was fairly new, so turning this on took more time and effort than I would have liked, but so far so good. Now, yes, the stair light was on, but the hallway at the top of the stairs was in complete darkness. My plan to run all the way went out of the window as I saw the darkness of the upstairs hall, so I slowly crept up the staircase. I got to the top step, then I saw it. In the corner of my eye, I saw a head peer out around the kitchen door. I wasn't imagining it, I know what I saw. There was someone watching me. I ran as fast as I could down the upstairs hallway and into my bedroom, slamming the door shut behind me. Terrified, crying, breathing heavily, I sat with my back against the closed bedroom door. I felt that feeling of dread, that empirical malevolence. Then I heard it, a sound that I will never, ever forget. As clear as the first time I hear it. The sound of someone or something scrambling animalistically up the stairs. I say animalistically, as it sounded like it was on four legs. My dog was outside, and I knew this as I could hear him barking in the garden. This was inside, on the stairs, and scrambling towards me. The sound paused at the top of the stairs, and a slow few steps were heard, again, most certainly four legs. Then, it ran down the hallway towards me. I actually screamed out, terrified and absolutely bawling my eyes out and shaking. I expected it to burst through the door to my room, but it stopped dead at the door, and the sounds ended. Not so long later, both my grandparents came home and found me crying in my room, curled up in bed. I told them everything that had happened, and my grandfather did a thorough search of the house, but of course couldn't find anything. It also caused my poor grandmother to spend many other nights sleeping in the chair next to my bed in order for me to get to sleep. I didn't know what my grandparents thought. I assumed they thought I was being a usual child afraid of the dark and creepy monsters at night. I assumed that for many years until once again, I read my grandfather's documents. You see, after this night, I experienced incidents like that for several years, and I always had the feeling in that house of being watched. I lived there until my teens, and I was certain there was a malevolent presence in that house. I also wondered if such a presence invaded or entered my dreams and caused my 2-year period of sleep paralysis, as sometimes the real-life incidents were hard to separate from the dreams. occasions became confusing for me, and in my mind to this day it's tricky to establish if something that happened in that house was a real encounter or played out in a sleep paralysis encounter. But I have over the years considered them one and the same. My grandfather's notes firmly dismissed mental health issues, thankfully. And later, when I told people who were studying psychology with me, there was a general consensus of possible hypnagogic hallucinations. But I know what I saw. I know what I felt, and I know what I experienced. It seemed my grandfather, Bernard Black, did too, as he stated in an extract from his documents, which I treasure to this day. It reads as so.
Jamie is an energetic, intelligent, and inquisitive young boy who doesn't display any of the signs of mental incapacity or behavior associated with any known mental disorder. My observations, and the impartial observations of my colleague Professor Michael Carrick, indicate all reason to believe that Jamie's behaviors, developmental functions, and psychological build are that of a common, everyday young boy of his age. That said, Jamie has experienced apparitions, sounds, sightings of persons unknown and unique and strange sensory perception that does not appear to be of common human experience. Jamie is convinced that the person in the house that's following him is the angry mother of a young girl he was friends but whom nobody else could see. This woman has appeared around the house and, he says, entered his dreams on numerous occasions. I have reason to believe that the so-called imaginary friend was an actual apparition that appeared to Jamie, and I believe the phenomena is linked scientifically to Jamie's age and only child status. Infrasound, radiation, and temperature readings were all at normal levels for the handful of incidents I have had the opportunity to record and measure right away. Carbon monoxide is not an issue in the home. Jamie continues to fascinate.
Obviously, there is a lot more to this story, and I'm sure at some point I'll reveal more and provide even more detail of my experiences growing up in a terrifying, yet loving home. I'm happy to receive questions and messages, as always, regarding tonight's episode, though, so please feel free to get in touch. I think I've explained in previous episodes about my opinion of ghosts and the paranormal, both from a personal and a psychological and scientific standpoint, so I won't reiterate. But I will say, although I am entirely a scientific, data and evidence-orientated individual, I know science has a lot to discover. Good night, everyone.
Thank you for taking the time to listen to our show tonight. Be sure to leave us a 5-star review on your chosen podcast platform and subscribe to our show so that you never miss an episode. Our shows aren't sponsored by any company or corporation, so any support you can give us goes a long way in supporting the work that we do. Visit deathcult.com for more information on how you can help us and support our broadcasts. There you can also find links to our socials, Patreon, and episodes. From all of us here at Dead Souls, sleep tight.